In times of crisis, in times of connection, artist Mel Chin makes his mark. A 2019 MacArthur Genius Award recipient, Mel Chin's artwork has been featured in major museums and biennials, in Times Square, the Halls of Congress, the television show Melrose Place, and Monument Lab's 2017 exhibition in the middle of Philadelphia's City Hall. When you see Mel Chin at work, you encounter an artist with purpose, with an eye toward building others up.
But I think the lesson from all those situations, this situation, is how to exercise self-critique and empathy. How do you have to rekindle it for each situation?
This episode, we speak to Mel Chin during a time of self-isolation and quarantine for COVID-19. We speak about how he and other artists stay connected during this time. We'll also hear about his new Source Studio and a fellowship for women, trans, and non-binary artists to spend time developing their craft. Plus, we'll hear what it was like when Mel heard that he was a MacArthur Genius Award recipient. I'm Paul Farber, and this is Monument Lab. Welcome to Monument Lab, public art and history podcast. Each episode, we explore stories and critical conversations about the past, present, and future of monuments. We speak to the artists, activists, and historians on the front lines, building the next generation of public spaces through stories of social justice and equity. Here are the monumental people, places, and ideas of our time. Mel Chin, welcome to the Monument Lab podcast.
Yes, Paul. It's been a while. Appreciate being here.
We're really glad to have you. First, I just want to ask you, how are you and the people close to you holding up in the pandemic?
I think we're fine. We're absolutely fine. And where I live is pretty remote, and so I do get a chance to go outside. Helen, my partner, is here, you know, so... And we're doing great and really thankful even that we have a opportunity to be part of something that could help a lot of people by just staying away from people. So by staying away, we ensure maybe we can get together again someday. So it's an important time. So I'm fortunate.
What are you doing to connect with other people that is either similar or different to the ways that you otherwise connect with collaborators, friends, people in your circles?
Well, you know, with all this fanciness, this high-speed internet, many things have not changed. You know, of course, we can't see each other face-to-face, but it looks like we're using all the usual devices from Skype to Zoom to connect, you know, in some shape or form. There's also just through the social media, which I'm active, sort of active, not that active. I've been able to connect with other people doing things that I could be part of, like printing gear for face shields. A group in North Carolina here at UNCA, University of North Carolina, were starting it, and I heard about it, and I had a 3D printer, and I said, well, I don't need to be there, but I can certainly print these things out, you know, and then supply that. But it's a time really to rethink things and of the projects that I've been just starting, Houston, Chicago, and Little Haiti in Miami, to think about how to approach them by keeping all of us free of infection, I guess, right? By staying away. And then how to move it forward. And so it's a different kind of conceptual setup. There is a frustration, I suppose, but knowing about the world and how, yes, individually by staying away, we can be very helpful in the bigger picture, but knowing about places that are in desperate conditions, you know, that don't have the luxury of my self-imposed kind of quarantine, like in India where their migrant workers are suffering and really, you know, so... it's almost like also musing on one's inadequacy in this time as well, no matter how much physical or digital connection we have.
You've worked in Flint in response to the lead poisoning water crisis, and you worked in New Orleans after Katrina. What insights do you have from your previous projects or ongoing work where there is a kind of natural disaster and social crisis that goes right alongside of it?
Well, what's happening here is so different, but I think the lesson from all those situations and this situation is how to exercise self-critique and empathy. How do you have to rekindle it for each situation? And the lessons from New Orleans and from Flint is essentially, it's not my work or my insight, but our insight and our work together that matters. So therefore, you recalibrate in this time to maintain that. That really, when you're working in the field and you're working on socially engaged kind of aspirations, that you absolutely know that it's, you just lost this rugged individualist mantle, you know, and so you follow through by trying to communicate with the mediums you have, but also understanding the projects have to have a different timeline maybe. And what I did learn from Flint and I did learn from New Orleans is that patience is and perseverance are essential, you know. That's like PPE, like personal protection, right? Equipment.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Patience, perseverance.
How do you deal with the uncertainty? I mean, sure, all the time we're living in uncertainty, but it's something that, you know, I hear from a lot of people now. I'm just curious how it hits you or affects you.
I'm pretty calm about it because I know that anything that approximated normal before was really not normal. That everything that is has happened has been a construction by all of us, right? And knowing that what will happen, almost understanding that there's no return to normal, and that and so therefore, I'm always kind of, you know, working on my own projects in terms of my artwork that I've been waiting to do, like personal pieces at the time. But I feel like everything is right now in preparation to be engaged in another kind of way. So I think it's a moment to, it's not exciting, but it's more or less like an obligation to be flexible in spirit and mind. And that's what you, how you deal with it, how I'm dealing with it, you know. There are moments when you engage long distance that there's opportunities to be silly, I guess. Not that this is the way this is going to go, Paul, but you know what I mean. You know.
I mean, I was thinking about, you know, we are about to see one of the largest stimulus packages in U.S. history go into effect. And it made me think about your Fundrid project, where you collected your own form of currency throughout the country and delivered it to Congress, to Capitol Hill. You know, for our listeners, it'd be great to hear about what the Fundrid project is, but also, did you gain any insights about the financial realities or even myths through gathering hand-drawn currency from 500,000 children and adults around the country?
I think, if anything, there are similarities with what's going on. I don't know about the stimulus package, but our project, the Fundrid project, was ignited by understanding that after going in to try to help, as many people did on a greater level, after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, I was struck that by my inadequacy as an artist singularly to do anything. And I realized after going back because of being inadequate, inadequate to address not the physical damage I saw, but the psychological and sociological damage that had occurred. After interviewing people with the great Rick Lowe and Tom Finkelpearl, we were all gathered there to help. And I was moved to understand that just because you're an artist, it's not enough. But what it stimulated is a return to come back again and again to research then what I could do and what I could do, what I could contribute to. And when I discovered that about half of the inner city childhood population were compromised by lead before the storm, and there was absolutely no stimulus package money going to them to alleviate that crisis in New Orleans, that's where the project begins. So I guess in a way, the similarities are this. We're dealing, the stimulus package is the outcome of an invisible kind of virus that we can't see, a threat you can't see, that absolutely transforms your life in a very negative way in some cases, but again, and maybe even temporarily, it will affect you. But lead in the blood of children of New Orleans or any place in all of America, which we eventually evolved the project into, does affect your life forever. And it is also invisible. So I think, but our stimulus was a way of coordinating these drawings and delivering them and becoming more than the artist figure. We became the delivery people to bring them eventually to the representatives of the people, the artists that drew hundreds. And therefore using that to speak about how lead had impacted their lives so that the decision could come from the representatives themselves to choose whether they desired to support a bill that is on the table right now. That's a bipartisan bill. It's the Lead Safe Housing Act for Children that's on the table. And it's still not done yet, you see. So what I've learned about finances or even support in Congress or in Senate is that it takes time. It takes time. And we're not done yet. We'll continue this project of attempting to bring the people who drew hundreds in front of their legislator so they have an opportunity to make sure that value of their expression can be put to good use. And that's the similarity between what the project is about. It is about value. Our value is pretty much the same. If the stimulus package is truly used correctly, it is for the benefit of the people.
With the Fundred project, you have a modified armored truck and you have vaults and you have piles of hand-drawn currency.
Yes.
What does that amount of paper of hand-drawn currency look like? Like, how do you move it around? Where is it? And how do you move it throughout the project?
Well, we figured a way to create it all in waterproof boxes and put them in banker boxes, the drawn pieces. We bundled them just the way you would bundle currency, but it's like 8,000 drawings per pack. I think there's 40-something plus bundles, and it all stacks up on a pallet that was created of oak and bronze that was elegantly and ornately detailed to do something that would be worthy of supporting 500,000 drawings by the people. So it's a project of the people, and it's for the people eventually, you know. And so the update on it, the collection as it stands now at the about approximately 500,000 has been donated to a prominent major American museum, a public museum. We'll let you know which one when they feel comfortable to release that. But at the same time, we haven't stopped. The whole concept, it doesn't stop just because we've put that within an institution. That institution has promised to accept more. And part of what we're doing in Chicago for an exhibition is to rekindle the project in Chicago, get the armored truck safe again. Got to fix those brakes, right? You don't want all that rolling through the streets of Chicago and neighborhoods where they've had enough trouble. They don't need more car trouble, you know? So we're getting that and we're bringing it up. We hope that we have to create a version of the safe house. We hope in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago, which is one of the most lead affected areas in the city. It also is a place where I had located the, in about 2010, maps that show the most heavy lead trauma to children had occurred in those areas of Chicago. I can't say there's a correlation because I'm not a doctor. You know, I'm not a Fauci or a Brick. But I could say that as far as the mapping goes, it corresponds with some of the most violent and sorrowful aspects of Chicago, which is the homicide rates that were occurring in and continue to occur in Chicago. So I've always been dedicated to thinking that the funded project should be where it could represent the best. And that's why we are not stopping the project yet. You know, it just because it needs to be in a safe collection. So it had to be given. It was not sold. Had to have a nice pallet. But the truck, the components, the safe house door can be exhibited. So we kind of evolved the way the project has to be. So it has to be flexible to meet the circumstances of our day. I think it parallels with this idea of invisible threat that we're encountering now. But I truly hope that the COVID-19 threat will end. But I'm going to say that so far, the threat of lead to the future of children all over the United States remains. So we will continue our quest, and maybe through the efforts in Chicago, we can continue, you know, to present what people have to say about it.
In your work and in our conversation, you talk a lot about the we, about collectives, about working with other people, that it's not just the artist. Is that an approach that you had to make a switch in your career to welcome other people into your creative process? Or has that been something that you've tried to do throughout your entire career?
Well, you know, I do studio work, and that satisfies the me. But if you are going to be engaged with others, then it automatically switches. It's almost like you don't have to make that decision. The decision's made for you, that it must be about the we, you know? You know? It's not going to happen. and it's disingenuous to pronounce otherwise. You know, when I went down to Flint, it was an interesting dynamic. You know, I had negotiated. I don't know if you know about the Flint Fit Project, but the Flint Fit Project was, I negotiated with a factory down here in North Carolina to take the bottles that people were using because they had to, you know, to not drink the poisonous water coming out of their tap. I negotiated if we brought a bunch of bottles, could they turn them into thread and into fabric? And then I went up to New York and I met the fabulous Tracy Reese, you know, the fashion designer, and spoke to her about this. I said, if I brought this fabric, would you be willing to design rainwear and swimwear out of this, you know? And if you create these patterns, would you mind if we go back to Flint and then go to this this New Life Sewing Center that's in a basketball court in a church in Flint, and have the women who are recovering from the effects of domestic violence being taught how to sew, and they could sew these things up, and then we could present this concept, this design called Flint Fit, and maybe eventually they could own it, you know? So it's a big arc of a project, right? But after negotiating all these yeses, fortunate yeses, I had to go back to Flint and then meet with a collective group. I had the great Melissa Mays, who's been fighting the lead poison waters that they still face, right, in Flint. And I asked Melissa and other people there to gather up community leaders from different neighborhoods from all over Flint. So there'd be a quality representation of the people of Flint. When I got there, it was a question to me first. They said, it's almost like, okay, Mr. Artist, you're here now. So what you want to do? You want to take some pictures so you can take it back to your gallery and show how we have to deal with this? Well, let me tell you, we know how to deal with it, and we don't need to show, we don't need to be just conveyed that way. And they also said, Hillary's been here. Trump's been here. Janae Monae has been here, and we still have poison water. So what could you possibly do as an artist, to help us out here? Other than that, you go and do your thing, but that's our position. So how are you going to make a difference? And so I squared with them basically that, no, I'm not going to be able to change the water crisis. I can't do that. But I told them about this Flint Fit project, and they became excited. And it was one of the first unanimous decisions to go forward with something that they've had in a long time. And because I told them basically, here's the dealio, we're going to do this. But if you say no right now, I'm going to walk away. I won't bother you, But the only thing I want to start off was I want to pay you so you can throw those dang bottles into this tractor trailer that I'm going to park out here. You fill that up, and I'll pay you for that first. Let's start there. You see? So that was interaction. I was very grateful for that. But that's, again, it's an example of you can have any idea in the world, but I think you got to run it by the people that are right in front of you that will be affected by it. And you got to talk straight and square. You know what I'm saying?
Have you ever had to walk away from a project because, as you said, you say it up front and things didn't align or the energies weren't right or, there was something off?
It's the opposite. I remember, and what has driven me to this, I was in Detroit back during Devil's Night time, and I had all these ideas about how to actually transform the house into these surrealistic kind of functioning mushroom houses, sinking houses, houses that could move, to undo the stigma that was associated with the people that lived there in Eastside Detroit, right? And I was in Eastside Detroit and presenting these ideas and full of it and really, really wanting to get the projects done and excited about the agrarian kind of revolution that was happening within the inner city of Detroit because of the abandonment of the city there. And they told me, I remember the gentleman coming up to me and saying, man, we really dig your ideas. You're cool. You're cool as can be, but you'll be gone. And I was shocked. I said, what do you mean? I just got here. And they essentially said, because no one helps poor people. You should know that. And a lot of people come with ideas, but in the end, you won't be supported. So I remembered denying that and going back and forth to Detroit on my own nickel, basically, to try to push this project. And sure enough, the money ran out and there was none coming. And I had to walk away. And I was struck by that when I was in New Orleans, when I started the funded project, when I was in the street and such goodwill with the project. And one of the local residents came up to me and said, okay, so you'll be going now, right? It's almost the same attitude of the people that are disenfranchised, can understand you want to help. They can understand the concepts you bring forward, and they loved working with you and all these things. But they have an understanding that they will be abandoned. So I looked at her and just said, well, you know something? You're right. I probably will not come back. But I'll be damned if something does not come back. And I will work until something does. And it may not be me. It may not be a physical thing. But it will be something. And that was almost 10 years ago when we started the funded project, and we're still in the thick of it. And I plan to continue to work on the funded project with by any means we can. And not right now, we started a 501c called, you know, SOAR Studio. And that stands for Sustained Operations Utilizing Resources for Community / Culture Environment. That's a mouthful, but that's what it stands for. You know, it's almost like a military operation, right? An acronym. But, you know, I don't plan to stop. And with the help of what we're trying to accomplish, we'll continue to understand that it's not just the project itself of Fundred, but it's how to work collectively and work as a team, the we, working with agencies that understand childhood lead poisoning, those that are working for many years, scientists that have been working many years to stop it, community leaders, now U.S. congressmen from the left and the right, you know, from both houses, and senators, and understanding it's not my say that said you should do this, but it's our say to say consider this. And maybe that something will happen from that. And then that will come back to New Orleans many years later. And every city that we've expanded it to include the entire country, that something will happen. And you don't have to even think about Fundred or me or anything else. But they can be rest assured that their contribution, if they drew a Fundred, was part of that package. You see? So it's not about my history, I guess. It's about actions that can be, that are part of a something that must be delivered, right? So, I mean, it's, yeah. And you know, it's no big deal, you know? It's, to me, it's, when you just think about it quietly, you know, of course it makes sense. A lot of these concepts to me are probably already done by others. And my feeling about it, they just make absolute logic to me. They're part of a reasoning that if the environment around me is made better, if people are free of a threat, then it makes my world better. So yeah, let's do this. Why not? You know,
in terms of SOAR Studio and how it makes sense for you and the projects that you've done and you will be doing, what is the origin of SOAR and how does it differ from your own artist studio or your own projects? Because you're the founder, but you also have a team now taking on SOAR Studio projects.
I'm not the director. I can engage in projects, you know, that are collective in nature, and I don't look to benefit from it. I certainly want to help it be sustained, but it looked like, aside from studio practice, you needed something that worked in these issues with meaningful engagements in the community that I learned. The things I've learned, the things I've been describing, it seemed like others could be supported in this kind of action. So just setting it up was an important thing, you know? So, I mean, I was always told to try to go that way. And so it has eventually happened. You know, when you work with foundations, thank goodness we had them, but there's also fiscal agencies and there's the timing it takes to wait for grants and sometimes, and also timelines of grants. And thank goodness for the help, but at the same time, you know, there are windows of support. So just coming up with something that could create that infrastructure and programming, and I could just be part of it. I could be part of something was important. You know,
one of the first projects of Source, you've announced the inaugural Karina Meal Fellowship for women, trans, and non-binary artists to have time and space to reflect and evolve their practice. And before speaking about the fellows, if it's all right with you, I want to ask you about the fellowship namesake, Karina Meal.
Karina Meal, miss her dearly, was probably the first person in many years that I was willing to entrust to be my studio manager. She was one of the strongest and most tireless people I'd ever met. And her ability to connect with people was profound. And, you know, I thought I was pretty good socially and breaking down boundaries, but Karina had that way that far superseded my capacities. And she really was such a special person that when we lost her to violence, horrible violence, it's almost like, you know, she's still present. And I think maybe a fellowship in her name guarantees her presence. Because if anything, I would almost say it was almost like, what would Karina do? You know, it wouldn't be about her. It would be supporting others. And so it made sense. It made sense. Of course, you know, I'm not alone in setting that up. You know, Amanda Wiles, our director of Source, you know, she was fundamental in pushing this forward. And this whole idea of Source was initiated, and some of the conversations and some of the bones of it, Karina was working on that before she was killed. So it makes sense that this award be for real and be put out there. So in the middle of a lot of bad news, the good news is we do have, you know, it's funny, we were supposed to name one fellow. We decided to increase the amount so we could have two fellows. And naming them, then we couldn't decide and said, no, we also need a honorary prize, you know. So it's exciting to support the people coming in and give people what I had in my development is a lot of generosity, you know. It's a space generosity. And I've been the beneficiary of that. So if I can just give all of that here, in the studio, that would be great. But it's also, I've been beneficiary of critique and engagement and conversation. So if anybody wants that, the studio is here for that, you know?
In going through the process of naming the fellows, was it healing for you in any ways?
Yes, it is. It is. And it will always will be because in a way that is how I feel someone can live. You know, if you think about them and then what better if some actions in her name, in Karina's name could happen, you know? And you know, even with this COVID crisis happening, it's also how we could create a fellowship or an action that is responsive, that is more flexible. You know, there's no strings attached. And right now, artists are in need. And so we have to give. If we have that capacity, then, and we're lucky to have that capacity, then we want to do this, you know? So in troubled times, you know, we want to be active and engaged with people. And I think it will spread. So it's you know, the process that you never will recover from certain things that happen in your life. But I think the bearability is dependent on the things you do to create that climate.
You know, you name the recipients, the artists Monique Muse Dodd and Jackie Sumel, with the honorable mention to Anaya Frazier, who's a former Monument Lab fellow as well.
Oh, she was? That's so cool.
Yeah.
She's a poet. She's a young poet.
That's
She's
right.
A young thing, you know. We just couldn't believe it. And so, well, we could believe it because it was evident.
Oh, she's remarkable. She's remarkable.
Yeah.
She was part of a collective.
Yeah.
And performed at our town hall last June at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
That's great. That's great. So we're glad she's got a little boost. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, it's almost like I'm going to say I'm looking for what they do. I'm looking forward to be part of supporting their effort, whatever it might be, supporting their life at this moment if it needs to be. It's okay, you know? So we're not going to have any pressure points, you know what I'm saying? Because I know how that feels. Did you give me any pressure? I don't think so. You're cool. You didn't give me any pressure when we were working together.
Well, yeah. I was thinking back. I was thinking back when we worked together in Philadelphia for Monument Lab 2017, the project To Me. I was thinking about it and thinking about the two pedestals with 90 feet of ADA accessible ramp behind them. Yeah. And over 50,000 people in the City Hall courtyard ascended to the top. And, you know, back then I loved seeing you connect with people, whether it was the mayor or average passersby. And I was just curious what you took away from that project, especially seeing people lined up to stand in the place of monuments, and not just that, but have to have someone else stand on the other pedestal and balance that. What did you take away from that project?
Well, it's interesting. I had an earlier conversation with Nato Thompson, and it reminded me of something that I've been thinking about a lot. And this relates, I guess, it's a hot topic, right? This COVID-19. But the idea of a virus is effective because it's also an incomplete form. It's not living quite yet until it connects and does what it does. So that can be a very negative outcome, by the way, as we know. But if you think about an artwork, especially a public artwork in the same way, that it really is not finished or is never completed until it engages. And that's what I'm thinking about, a sense of actually seeing a work that is being completed time and time again when people are going up there and just being what they wanted to be themselves. They could be a me. Yeah, I know. They had to confront with some other me on the other side, but I don't know how that worked in the head, but it was really completed at the moment when that I saw someone in a wheelchair come up there, because that was the thing, you know? So I think it's about how concepts are completed by the we. And that was a really, let's say it was not subtle. That's a direct project, right? Thank you very much, Monument Lab, you know, and the posse. Because the Philadelphia Posse, y'all did it, you know? You helped make something realized. And I think what it is like a virus or a concept is like incomplete or just a notion, theory, or something that is completed in this way and fulfilled. You know what I'm saying?
Well, thank you. And, you know, your presence, you know, in the months leading up to the project, but of course during the installation and even the kind of turning over to the people of Philadelphia, it was profound to watch. And, you know, I remember that moment that the mayor is talking to you during install, having this really direct conversation, and he never stops moving his feet, but you two are locked in conversation.
I liked him. Is he still there?
He's still in office, Mayor Kenney.
Well, I think Philadelphia is going through some stuff, right? Because is it spreading down there?
It is, yeah. But we're all shut down, and we're all, you know, trying to do our part.
Well, if you see Mayor Kenney, please give him my regards and my hopes that things will transform in Philadelphia. I really appreciated his thoughts about it and his allowance for it to be there. So, and anyway, that really made that piece.
That's right. That's right. And your idea that summoned it. You know, I'd be remiss not to ask, the end of 2019 brought big news that you were awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm curious where you were when you heard the news.
Oh, okay. When they announced it, I was digging a hole to uncover some plumbing leak in the yard. But when they called, you know, they always call you. I didn't know that. I've never received a MacArthur, obviously. So, and was not expecting one. I'm not imbued with a particular genius that would imagine that I would ever get one. So, that was never part of my you know, quest. Of course, it can't be anyway. So what happened was that friends from Santa Cruz were coming in to interview me, but they're traveling across the country. They had been interviewing artists for quite a while, you know. And so, you know, I said, okay, come on in. I'll sit for an interview. And so they were all professional. They brought in all the equipment, a cameraman and everything, you know. So I said, man, they're serious about this interview, so I got to get ready. So I looked at my phone and someone was trying to call and I didn't have time. And I saw it was a call from Chicago. You know, and the phone kind of tells you the area code. And I'm just saying, well, it's wow, you know, telemarketer calling all the way from Chicago. Wow, I don't have time for that. And then I walk away and they're preparing outside. And then there's a text message saying you have to call this morning. And I said, well, now that is a new low, you know, telemarketer coming in and texting me, telling me what to do. Well, I think I'm going to give them a piece of my mind. You know, I think I will call them. So I call. So I said, just a second, you know, I'm going to go back in and give a call. And it's, this woman's voice comes on and asks, are you alone? I was just about ready to say, you know, I'm not alone. I'm actually ready to shoot a film. But I got cut off when she said, I'm asking because I'm calling from the MacArthur Foundation. So I kind of rearranged my thoughts very rapidly and didn't complain. I didn't ask her, in other words, to take my number off the call list. So that's what happened. And then I had to keep it quiet. I couldn't tell anybody. And that was the routine. So I was just getting ready for an interview and ready to tell them off, you know, but was stopped when they identified themselves. And then it's a matter of just staying calm and not mentioning it to anybody. You know what I'm saying?
How did you cope with keeping it in? It's major life impacting news. A lot of people were rooting for you. How did you keep it in, and what was the experience like when you were finally able to share it?
Well, you know, because I'm a little bit older, you know, I think they kind of even mentioned it in the New York Times that I was the oldest of the group to ever get one. But, and maybe age is not no prerequisite for this, but I kind of took it upon, I understood the magnitude of the award, and I felt a deep sense of obligation to do more. That's how I dealt with it. Like, it's almost, it wasn't apprehension type, like, oh no, I got to go right back into the mine, you know? But in a way it was. Like, this is confirmation of a life's work, and that life's work is not done. And that's how I think about it. So let's get busy. Let's go to Chicago. Let's go to Little Haiti. Let's go to Houston. Let's go to Greenland, the edges of Greenland, and watch the world fall apart, you know? And let's try to be re-educated. So the internal voice is humbling, and it's confirmation that more must be done. That's really how I feel about it.
Melchin, thank you so much for joining the Monument Lab podcast. It's always a treat to talk and think with you.
Yeah, right on, Paul.
To learn more about Mel Chin and Source Studio, visit sourcestudio.org. You can read more about Mel Chin's Monument Lab project, To Me, on our website, in the projects page, or in our book, out now through Temple University Press. Next episode, we'll hear from Lycan Jordahl, documenting the destruction of environmental and cultural heritage sites along the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Jordahl works at the Center for Biodiversity and is a former National Park Service fellow. Monument Lab is produced by Monument Lab Studio, Justin Geller and Paul Farber. Extra assistance comes from studio manager Yannick Trapman O'Brien, designer William Hodgson, and communications director Patricia Kim. All music you hear on the Monument Lab podcast is by Mokita. The Monument Lab podcast is supported by the Cerdna Foundation. To find out more about Monument Lab, visit us at monumentlab.com or find us online at monument_lab. You can find Monument Lab anywhere you get podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play. You can also read a full transcript of each episode on our website. If you like what you hear, subscribe and leave a rating. Your feedback really helps.